to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the new enclosures, the appropriation of public land in neoliberal Britain. It's a book just out by Brett Christophers, and we're looking particularly at the way that applies to what's happening over at Stoke Lodge, where Bristol City Council have allowed Cottam School to fence off this public land so that local people can no longer use it. And Trevor Mealham, he's a Lloyds Bank victim, he says. He's the founder also of the Independent Network of Estate Agents in the UK and a former advisor to the government on property fraud. Property fraud, he says, he's become a victim of himself. Now, Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Panel are now investigating Trevor's claims that the police commissioner, Sue Mount Stevens, has failed to hold our police to account for not acting on evidence of alleged fraud by the Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit, which is based here in Castle Park. I'd stress we do not support Trevor's claims, but believe they must be aired in the public interest. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name is Brett Christophers. I'm an Englishman living in Sweden. I'm a university teacher and researcher at Uppsala University in Sweden. I've been in Sweden for 10 years now. And I work in a geography department as a human geographer. A lot of the research I've been doing in the past 5 years or so has been to do with land ownership, also looking at the recent history of changes in land ownership, specifically in Britain. So the original enclosures was not really one event. It was a long, drawn-out set of processes, beginning really many centuries ago, but really concentrated in the period from the mid-18th century until the end of the 19th century. Across Britain was a set of processes whereby Britain's commoners, the mass of the population, lost their rights to use and access common land. So common land wasn't land that was owned publicly or in common. It was typically privately owned, but people that didn't own the land had these common rights to access and use the land for, you know, pasture and picking berries or whatever else it might have been, and therefore to sustain themselves. And through the enclosure movement, those lands, those common lands, were enclosed, literally, through putting up hedgerows and stuff like that. What that meant was that millions of people who had been accustomed to sustaining themselves through their relationships with this land could no longer do so. The reason it was such an important period in English history, in British history, was that not only did millions of people lose their ability to sustain themselves, to maintain their traditional livelihoods, but it was fundamental to the kind of the birth of industrial capitalism, because those newly landless people became, in moving to the cities, they became the new industrial workforce that was essential really for the birth and growth of industrial capitalism. They became the new waged labour because they had to find another way of sustaining themselves. So the enclosure movement was really central to the change in Britain from a feudal society to a capitalist society between the 18th century and late 19th century, as I say. So it was a pivotal period in British history. And something like a third to a half of the whole of Britain underwent this process of enclosure. So it was really, really fundamental to what happened in terms of the historical transformation of Britain in that period.
Now, I mean, we can see on our maps here in Britain, if you open up an Ordnance Survey map, quite often it will say there's the site of a medieval village, you know, so that would be one that was enclosed. In other words, the houses were torn down, the stone used maybe for building walls, fences, new structures to keep people out of the newly privatised land. But your book is about the new enclosures. You're saying that this process is very much alive still today.
what I'm trying to refer to in the book, it's a different set of processes, but what I'm trying to argue, and this is why I use the term, is that although it's a different set of processes, what I'm suggesting is that although it definitely hasn't happened on the same scale, it potentially has a similar set of consequences. So what the new enclosure is another form of land privatisation. So if the original enclosure was essentially the privatisation of rights to access and use the land rather than ownership, the new enclosure is literally the privatisation of ownership. So what it involves is the sale of publicly owned land to the private sector. So this is land that was owned by one or other public body, which can be a central government department, for example, the health service. It could be the Department of Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA. It could be the Ministry of Defence, or it could be, in many cases, a local authority, so a district council or a city council. And what's happened over the last 40 years, really since the beginning of the 1980s, is that public bodies across the length and breadth of Britain have come under increased pressure from a central government, so from Whitehall, essentially, so from the Prime Minister's office, from the Treasury, from the Cabinet office, to dispose of their land, to privatise their land, and in doing so, hand it over to the private sector. And so that's what the new enclosure is about.
Okay, now, just to put Bristol into context here, in the 1990s, I can remember reading somewhere that Bristol, as a proportion of the land area that's controlled by the local authority, Bristol City Council, had the largest proportion of land owned by the city council of any other local authority in the country. And it's quite clear, you're right, you know, they are divesting themselves of this land, they are selling it off. Can you actually quantify across the country the extent to which this is happening? Now, that's obviously not the easiest thing to do, Brett, but it's extremely useful if we can see how much land has been privatised in the last 40 years.
Yeah, so that's one of the things I tried to do in the book, and I think we can do it, although it takes a bit of piecing together. So the way you can't do it is by saying, OK, I'm going to look at every single land transaction that's taken place and figure out how much land's been sold in each case and then kind of tot it all up. And you can't do that for a number of reasons. One is that there's just been so many individual sales, literally tens of thousands, maybe even as many as 100,000. So first of all, it would just be a daunting process. And second of all, the information would not, in many cases, be made available. And thirdly, the information is literally doesn't exist. So it's fairly clear that many public bodies, until quite recently, actually just haven't kept records of what's been sold, how much it's been sold for, who it's been sold to, and so on and so forth. So you literally couldn't do that. What you can do, though, is say, OK, we're going to look at the question of how much land the state, so the government, local and national, owned when this process began at the end of the 1970s. And we're going to look at how much land the state owns today, and then we'll extrapolate between the two. And so that's what I did. And in the late 1970s, some research was done that indicated that at that time, in total, the state owned about 20% of the land across Britain, whereas today the state owns roughly about half that amount. So we're talking about going from about 4 million hectares of publicly owned land to roughly just over 2 million hectares of publicly owned land. So roughly an area about 10% of Britain by area has been sold off. And one thing is, and we can say a bit more about where that land has come from. So roughly about 20% of that, so about 400,000 hectares, was actually land that was not sold as land. It was land that was owned by public enterprises that were privatised, and it was privatised along with them. So I'm talking about the water companies, the electricity companies like National Grid, the National Coal Board, and so on and so forth. So about 400,000 hectares disappeared into private ownership with the utilities. And then of the rest, a lot's come from the Forestry Commission, a lot's come from the Ministry of Defence, and a lot has come from local authorities. So the numbers I've got anyway suggest that probably local authorities have been hardest hit and that something like 60% of the land that local authorities cumulatively owned at the end of the 1970s has been privatized in the period since then. And you're quite right to say that the proportions that were owned in different parts of the country varied quite a lot. So in some cities, the local authorities owned a lot of land, and in some they owned less land. And getting down to a more granular level would be very, very difficult and take a lot of research. But overall, about 60% of local authority land has gone to the private sector.
Weston, Supermare and Filton, both airfields, which most people driving around the southwest, around the Bristol area will know, are now being built all over with housing. What extent is this actually coming back to the... You know, what I'm trying to say here is, how much value for money has the Ministry of Defence got, or British Aerospace in the case of Filton Airfield? How much do we know how much money, value for money they've got by selling off this land?
Well, again, it's a really difficult question to answer. I mean, there's a few things I can say in response to that. The first thing to say is that this is one thing that the government, local and national, can't really be criticised for, but a lot of this land that was sold maybe 10, 20, 30, even 40 years ago was sold just on the cusp of Britain entering a period of unprecedented inflation in land prices, in land values. So the reality is that the state didn't secure value for money in many cases because it sold it, and then all of a sudden land prices shot up, and obviously those land value gains have been realised by the private sector. I think a second thing you can say, if you look through the historical record, and I think this is a really important point, is that another reason that value for money was not secured for taxpayers is that very often land was sold in situations of, well, actual or effective compulsion. So the public body was under such pressure to sell from central government. And as anyone who knows anything about land markets will tell you, you don't tend to secure market value for a piece of land if you're selling under conditions of compulsion, because the market can smell out a forced buyer that's entering some kind of fire sale. So I think it's pretty clear that in many cases, value for money was not secured. And there's plenty of specific examples where exactly that's happened, which I talk about in many cases in the book. So, you know, sure, in some cases, market value would have been secured. In others, in many others, not. But even where it was, you know, it was sold before, you know, land prices really, really shot up. If you look at the value of the land that was privatized today, that land is worth vastly more in most cases today than it was when the government sold it off.
Well, what about the National Health Service? You mentioned the NHS there. Have they been selling off? Because as far as I know, most of the hospitals that were there 10 years ago are still there. They haven't been sold off, have they?
So the NHS is a tricky one, obviously, because of the structural transformation that's gone on in the health service over that long period. So when this period began, so around the late 1970s, the best information I've seen is that the health service in its totality owned around about 50,000 acres, which I'm just trying to do my maths, it's just over 20,000 hectares. And I think today the health service in its totality owns about 6,000 hectares. So about 70% of the land that was owned by the health service at the beginning of the period has been sold off. So yeah, health service land has been ravaged, actually, and it's still being sold off today.
So that's actual hospital sites going, or is it grounds of hospitals? What's being sold off? Do we know?
It's both. I mean, it's definitely both. And a lot of this is to do, you know, is actually quite understandable. You know, one of the big, this is definitely not my area of expertise because it's not talking about land per se, but obviously the move away from long-term institutional care for people that were, you know, chronically ill, either mentally or physically, towards care in the community, meant that there was a massive deinstitutionalization of the health service, particularly in the 1980s. And that saw a lot of land and property being freed up and sold off. But, you know, across the public sector as a whole, there's been a push to, you know, to as the word that's used being to rationalise the estate and to, you know, to cram employees and services into ever smaller areas in an efficiency drive, and that's kind of freed up this excess of surplus property to be sold off.
So who's okay? This is the other end of the coin, I suppose, the other side of the coin. Who bought this land? Who's been buying all this land?
I mean, that's obviously a difficult question to answer as well, because of the fact that the record keeping has been so poor. What we can see from the records is that, you know, let's split this into two issues. On the way, there's housing land on the one hand, so land that was basically sold off with housing under the right to buy program, which was obviously bought by the tenants of those properties. But leaving aside housing land and thinking about all other land that's been sold, it's been primarily property companies that have been buying it, but also financial institutions. So when I'm talking about property companies, I'm talking about companies like, you know, Land Securities Group and British Land, but also property developers like Berkeley Group, like Taylor Wimpey, like Persimmon, and then also financial institutions like Legal & General and Aviva are massive landowners today, but also retailers, for example, Tesco and so on. So there's a wide swathe of companies that have been involved in buying this land. But particularly, I would say that over the last decade or so, it's been heavily concentrated on property developers, precisely because the main reason that the government has been pushing this, particularly over the last 7 or 8 years, is the rationale being to enable the construction of more housing in the face of Britain's housing crisis. So that's been the rationale that's been given, is we need to sell off this surplus public land to free up land that the property sector needs in order to build the housing that Britain needs.
Brett, what can we do about this?
Well, the first question, before asking that question, I think the question that's worth asking first of all is, you know, why would one want to do anything about this? You know, is this something that is per se, on balance, a bad thing or a good thing? My own conclusion in the book is that it's on balance definitely a bad thing. I think that, you know, partly because of what the public sector loses, but also partly because of what the private sector has tended to do with the land that has been handed over. I think there's very limited evidence of good things coming of privatisation and plenty of evidence of bad things coming of it. I think that one of the big problems is that the private sector tends to do things with any of its assets, whether it's land or anything else, things that are profitable. And there are a whole series of things that we as a society need from land that the private sector typically doesn't deliver because it's not in its interest to do so. And examples of things like that would be genuinely affordable housing. If land is being handed over to the private sector, it's in the private sector's interest to use that land in a way that maximises profits. That's what the private sector does. And I think that through selling the land, the state has gradually but consistently lost the ability to continue to do certain things with the land that it's only really the public sector that does. And I think, you know, one of the really striking things now is that, you know, in the last year or two, we've heard more and more talk about local authorities returning to building social housing at scale for the first time in a generation. But now they're thinking about doing that, they're actually realising that in many cases they no longer have the land that they need to do it because it's been sold off. And there are many other examples as well, things like providing allotments, for example, local councils. There's enormous queues nationwide because the land's all been sold off. So I think on balance it has been a negative development, and I think the fact that it's ongoing is a bad thing. And I think that it should be stopped. But I think the key thing I would say is that the impetus to do that has to come from central government. So I have a huge amount of sympathy for local authorities who have seen their grants from central government slashed by 50, 60% or more in the last decade. they're desperate to continue to provide the services that they're charged with providing, and they have less income from central government to do that. And that puts the finances of local authorities under enormous pressure. And I think under those conditions, it's almost natural for local authorities to try to liquidate whatever assets they can in order to stay afloat financially. So I think the impetus has to come from central government. And the central government has a responsibility, I think, to enable public bodies, to be in a position where they don't feel compelled to continue to sell off their assets, and that they will be able to use them in a way that in ways that are socially beneficial. And I think right now, across the public sector, lots of land-owning public bodies do not feel capable of behaving in a way with their land that provides the social benefits that people expect them to provide.
Are there any legal techniques or approaches that people can use to keep access to public land? Because what we're seeing, increasing pressure is for local authorities to either lease that land out, which may have been parkland, that sort of thing. Are there any ways to hang on to it and keep it available for public use?
Well, certain public bodies, including local authorities, when they sell land, they're under an obligation to provide notice of their intention to do so. For example, in local media, people can register their view on that. But as far as I know, the local authorities, they're obliged to listen, but they're not obliged to actually act on what people say. So if people locally say, no, we don't want you to sell the land, the local authority, I think, is well within its rights to say, well, we'll listen to you, but we're going to go ahead and do it anyway.
What can people do in that situation? Because surely, I mean, some of these bits of land, say, for example, they're the green lungs of the city. It may be that there simply are no other, say, public parks or places to walk the dog or whatever within walking distance or within any kind of reach. Is it actually legal for a local authority to say, well, actually, we don't have to provide you with any parks. I'm sorry, we're going to be building on this one.
It's a good, you know, that is a good question. I don't know the answer to that question. But I've never come across anything that suggests that that there are constraints on local authorities' ability in terms of how far they can go with the process. I don't know the answer to that question as to whether they actually have to provide space or land, for want of a better word, for certain things, like, for example, public parks. And parks absolutely are one of the types of public space that are under immense pressure and are being sold off quite a lot across the country at the moment. I mean, one of the things that a lot of groups are trying to do across the country is to say to local authorities, look, if you really do want to sell this land, then sell it to us. We'll put together, you know, a bid as a community group to buy the land instead of you selling it off to a property developer. But the problem there is that, you know, if it comes to a competition on price between a community group and a property developer with deep pockets, then it's pretty obvious who's going to win. And as I said earlier, you know, if you're the chief executive or the chief financial officer of a local authority trying to balance your budget, then it's pretty difficult to imagine that they're going to say, okay, we'll accept the significantly lower bid. Even if, you know, on principle they might prefer to do so, in practice it's very difficult for them to do that. The book is called The New Enclosure, and the subtitle is The Appropriation of Public Land in Neoliberal Britain. It's published by Verso. I believe it's available in, for example, in local Waterstones, but it's also obviously available on the web. In fact, I think probably the cheapest place to get it is from Verso's own website.
Brett Christophers, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Brett Christophers talking to me from Sweden, author of The New Enclosures, The Appropriation of Public Land in Neoliberal Britain.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Trevor Melam. I'm a Lloyds Bank victim. I've been into property for 33 years. I set up and founded the Independent Network of Estate Agents. I believe very much in estate agents working together on a co-brokerage system, much like the Americans, MLS multi-list systems, which actually began in the UK and then went to America, grew in New York, Rebney, and so on. But the Americans took it in a co-broker way, and the UK took it in a more of a singular agent.
Can you just explain in a nutshell the difference between the systems?
The Americans have got more intelligence to realise that half of something is better than nothing, and you can't sell what you haven't got. So the American system means that as a real estate agent, you work for a brokerage. So that could be like a Remax or something like that. But you might, you know, you'll sell your own properties, but you also sell and offer other agents' properties. And if somebody else has got something that somebody wants, it's a lot easier to sell it than trying to pitch something that you've got that nobody wants or the person doesn't want. So the Americans talk about 6% commission, but it doesn't actually work out a lot different to what an agent would earn in the UK. An agent in the UK roughly works on 1.5%. An American might charge 5-6%, but then half goes to that brokerage and that brokerage, and it gets split again between the brokerage and the realtor.
So what happened with your banking then? Because obviously you would have had to, I imagine, borrow some money to invest in this business.
No, we didn't have to borrow any because I had quite a few buy-to-let properties, and I got bought out on my two estate agency offices, which were very traditional models, and we're fine. So we set up a prop tech. I sold some of my investment properties, and that's fine. And then we had to sell another property and put a bit more money in. But basically, we got to a point where we built it up to 650 estate agency offices, and we were near break-even on revenue. We created a freemium model. The technology that I created was next generation to Rightmove and Zoopla because it was a multi-directional property data feed, whereas Rightmove and Zoopla only take the data from the agent software upwards. So building INEA, prior to that, I got chaired a group called Linear, which was Local Independent Network of Estate Agents. Local because most people move locally. But when I set up INEA, we wanted it to be something that could be national. So it had to be a technology platform rather than just a paper-based multi-list as the prior system. And I designed a system. I found a really good team of IT down at Hastings that way. We built, we invested about £1 million. And along the way, we had a bit of lending from Lloyds. You know, we were going to bring more investment in. And then I had an idea, why don't we take properties to the people on digital screens with our software fee type, which is different to Rightmove Zoopla. And Lloyds Bank said, we really like that idea. You'd be applicable for an EFG loan. I said, what's that? And they said, it's the Enterprise Finance Guarantee. You'd be applicable for $200,000. So we said, what have we got to do? And they said, well, it's the Enterprise Finance Guarantee. You'd be applicable. And, you know, the idea was we'd use the money. We always carried a float of about 20, 30,000 overdraft anyway for the buy-to-let properties we had. So new kitchens, bathrooms, repairs, and so on. But the bank said, you know, you'd be applicable £200,000 loan, EFG, Enterprise Finance Guarantee. You need to come in with a chartered accountant. You need to quantify all your figures. So we've done all that. So it wasn't like it was just getting it. We done it properly and planned and forecast and everything else. Lloyd said, yep, we're back you, and so on. So we didn't know the full process, but they increased the overdraft to allow us to build these prototypes that we call remote agent. Once we got a prototype in the County Square, Ashford, we had another one with the ex-National Association president in Norwich. He had that at a golf course. And we had some agents testing units. And we had another unit in a local store. And the idea was we could broadcast properties anywhere and like a shopping mall where you can't have an estate agent normally because it's retail, you can have digital signage. So we thought, great. We got to about 87 foul, and Lloyds then needed to come through with the other 113, 115, which was our sales and marketing money, all in the plan, mini call centre, sort of four salespeople. They said no. So what they'd done, they'd increased, put us in toxic debt. They'd increased it on the overdraft and said, you've now got to go to a loan, because we wasn't actually in the EFG. We thought that was just how it worked. It was allocated. I said, this is all going to end in tears. And what they did, they pushed us into the loan, so toxic lending. We then thought that they had deaded the overdraft account in Kent, and instead they moved it to Lloyds BSU. We thought it was deaded.
That's the business support unit.
Business support unit, yeah. Lovely lot there. And you need business support, you go there. And what they'd done, they were running up debt into it. But what we now know from the DSAR, the data subject access request, we found loads of gold nuggets in it. We know that our local branch had closed the bank statements down, closed the internet banking, closed the ATM cards. So as far as we knew, we had no way of looking for that account. As far as we knew, it was dead. They moved it over to BSU and run a load of debt in it. They also, we now know, run drive-by valuations at two-thirds below market value on our property. We then said on the loan that we were running on, the 87 thou, it was always close to the borderline. And the interest rate, I think, was about 26%. So we were always falling into really heavy toxic debt. And we said, this is just unworkable. We've had a report done by Professor Nigel Harper, and he basically says what they should have done was come through with the full 200, or said to you, no, we're not going to back you on this side business plan, just keep with the main business, which was near break even. But what they did, by going midway, they increased us to our real toxic debt and then pulled the rug. And nothing then to, you know, no extra funding to furnish the extra debt. We also now know from the DSAR that staff at Lloyds were supposed to set up the direct debits that we'd asked for, like Rightmove, Zoopla do, to get customer payments in. We've now got the evidence that they should have done that, and they kept agreeing to do that, but they just never came through with it. So they pushed into toxic debt and made it even harder to get payments in. We've also found in the DSAR, we found a loan of £250,000 that we never had. So we think they gave us toxic lending, which they promised of 200, which only went to 87. And then what they've done a thing called rehypothecation. And then they've gone ahead and borrowed £250,000 against my name and ID and kept it in shadow banking. So it's really filthy. We know what Lloyds do. I mean, for 10 years with INEA, I became a government stakeholder advisor to HMRC on the third and fourth money laundering directives. I've also worked alongside the Office Fair Trade, which then went, and the current guidance on residential property sales, which is trading standards. I put a hell of a lot of input into that. Things really struggled for 3-4 years. We kept selling our buy-to-let properties. Lloyds were, you know, really nasty charges on our property. And they really pushed us to the limit. We then got paperwork that we had to go to court. They used Ashford's Law. Horrible lot. Real rats in the mud. They lied on affidavits, that sort of thing. I then found SME Alliance and on Twitter other victims. And I started talking to people. And one lady that had been pushed by NatWest and Ashford's Law, her husband had tried 3 times to kill himself. Ashford's Law is a firm of solicitors. I burnt them out for Lloyds, so Lloyds sacked them a week after the 22nd of October. I called them out in High Court. So Lloyds took me to court. I said, we believe the loan has been securitized. That went on. Their barrister lied about securitization assignment on affidavits. We had three bench judges in county court, and we had two good judges. And the last judge, I said, look, I've got a report here from Professor Nigel Harper, who is the ex-head inspectorate for retail banking for HMRC. He's helped jail 13 bankers. He helped Anthony Stansfield with the Lloyds HBOS 6. And really decent guy, one of the top UK professors of banking. I've also had a forensic accountant. And what you've got to do when you go through all this, you've got to build a team around you. So the biggest problem Lloyds have got is some of the regulation guidance out there has actually come from me.
What was the motive for Lloyds, do you think, in your case?
Oh, well, what happened was, obviously, 2007, the banks run into trouble from, it was a shoot-off from America. Securitization is the way that banks lend. It's shadow banking makes up 60% of banking. But no, Lloyds, RBS, Barclays, they all screwed up. And someone's got to pay. The government borrowed money from Europe, and it had to be paid back. What the banks didn't count on was 2010-11 was the PPI court cases in the High Court under Judge Ousley, when PPI went from being lawful to unlawful. And in 2010-11, the banks realised we're going to have to pay out tens of billions. So now what's the plan? So what their plan was, and this, I believe, ties in with Treasury as well, and, you know, there's a couple of high-up politicians at the moment, and they're gatekeepers, they're blockers. And so what the banks did, how do we get more money? Well, let's start breaking down a lot of the SMEs. So what they did, they do a thing that trading standards were called bait and switch, which is where they bait you into toxic lending and then pull the rug. So in my case, they promised a loan of 200. They went to 87. They then pulled the rug. We didn't have the funds to facilitate the plan. So you back spiral. They then jiggle bits about. The overdraft, we thought, they then placed a BSU and we didn't know. And then what kicks in is the 2006 Fraud Act, where Party A, the bank, sets out to deceive Party B, us or any other bank victim, for the permanent loss of money, property, intellectual, for Party A's gain or Party B's loss or both. You then need to prove mens rea, which is the mental thought of, well, we can do that because we've got emails between staff that show conceal this, this and this. We've got emails that read the heat is on as they're pushing us into more toxic debt. We've got emails that show Mr. Melam can't afford the repayments on the loan they were pushing me into. You've then got actus reus, which is the actioning of. So we can show between one lot of staff saying do this, do that to make it more toxic, and then other staff actioning that. But the problem was for Lloyds, I then got the DSAR come through, data subject access request. It took us 3.5 months to go through, but then we could see all these gold nuggets, like loans, the £250,000 we never had. And the thing is, with banks, you've got civil and criminal fraud happening. Maybe local staff that are enticing people in and they're doing their job and they're following what the computer says. Fill in this form, do this, do that, yet you'd be applicable for that. And then you've got the higher middle management that you don't see. And they're the ones that are engineering it. And a lot of their planning and bits like that, a lot of it depends on the risk factor. If the bank is in debt itself, they will run the higher risk.
What's this meant for you, though, as a businessman?
I've been involved the last 10 years on a lot of property fraud consultations and that sort of thing. So when we realised what they'd actually done to us, and I started looking, analysing the patterns which people weren't seeing, it all then went bong. You know, suddenly it kicked in 10 years of going up to the government and Home Office and a lot of fraud consultations that were sort of fairly secret, security and that sort of thing. I always wanted to see consumers protected. We also had our own commercial model to look after. So I got very involved in rightful law and making suggestions to make it a better industry. So when we discovered what had happened, I thought, no, we're going to fight it. You're not going to do this to us. And now what I do, I help a lot of the other victims because I know the patterns. I looked at one today, started telling me bits. And I said, well, it's bait and switch and 2006 Fraud Act. So at the moment, I'm actually enjoying it because I got Lloyds elevated to the High Court, which they didn't like. I've seen off one of their barristers. I've seen Ashford's Law get blown out. And to be honest, Lloyd's legal team, RBS's legal team, they all do the same crap, and they all catch everybody out the same way. But with me, I know their patterns, and parts of it, I know more than they do about property law.
So what would you say to listeners now who, you know, just all, I suppose, forewarned is forearmed, isn't it? So, you know, to sort of be, what to be aware of that the banks might try to pull?
Well, the whole thing of this asset stripping, it's obviously based on assets that, you know, 95% of it will be bricks and mortar property. And the bank might see, you know, if we entice someone toxic debt. The other thing they don't do is they don't update the land registry. So when I had meetings with the CEO of Land Registry, I established with him, his head of legal and head ledger clerk, that if the bank doesn't update the land registry that they've sold on the loan, well, they haven't got the loan agreement because they've sold it on. So they don't have the wet ink agreement. So what they do, they bring into court the land registry charge. Well, the thing is, that becomes false because they've not updated it. It'd be like buying a car road tax disc. And when you buy it with 12 months duty, it's correct. Not that we have them now. But the thing is, if you cashed in the duty on it, and you had a photocopy, that photocopy may look identical, 100% the same. But the thing is, because the intellectual, the duty is gone, it's false. So with land registry, it's true. But then what happens when they sell the loan on, because they've not updated who the beneficial owner of the repayments go to, that land registry document that shows the bank as the rightful owner is false. So what I said to the judge, I said, what their barrister wants to do is bring in a fraudulent document to steal my property. And the following week, they sacked their solicitors, Ashford Law. So I think things to watch out for, NatWest at the moment are running an advert, paperless mortgages. I've run the other way from it because you want the wet ink signature. And if you can say to the bank, when you found out they've done this to you, okay, where's the wet ink signature? They won't have it. So then you've got a big question. Should you even be taking me to court? Because you've done fraud.
What about the police and crime panel? And maybe you can explain, you know, how Avon and Somerset has become embroiled in all of this.
Yeah, it's corrupt. They've got corrupt detectives in there. What Lloyds wanted, they wanted a police force that they could buy off because, you know, I don't know how many there is. If there was 50 or 60 police forces in the UK, if every time you get a victim you've done fraud on, if you've got to buy off Kent Police and you've got to buy Liverpool Police and all that, it'd be impossible. So why not set up a business support centre in guise that it's going to support people that have fallen on hard times? Why are they falling on hard times? That's the first question. But if the victims go to Bristol and then they make it even more toxic, most people just collapse. And what the banks want is people with no money, so they can't fight it. We didn't have solicitors. So I've been a litigant in person. I'm sort of the expert witness that a bank would probably want, but they've got me on the other side. So the thing is, if all the people that do find out then report it to the police, you want the keystone cops, the corrupt cops that say, oh, no, there's no fraud there. So it keeps going through court. So then when someone says, but it's criminal fraud, and then the other side say, no, Your Honour, no, my lord, the police haven't got involved. They couldn't find any fraud. Well, if you buy off they're covering up fraud with fraud. So over on the Somerset Police have got bent detectives, and they're quite senior. And so they can never find fraud. But in my case, I've been an advisor on fraud. So that's why I could quote you an abbreviation of what the Fraud Act is. That's why I know what bait and switch is. That's why Kent Police the other week didn't know what bait and switch was, which is a standard trading standards term. So, you know, and the whole thing is funneled through. You've got to go to Action Fraud, and then it goes up to City of London Police. Well, that's a joke, because you've got the Keystone Cops in there. In the Treasury Select Committee the other week, you got Nicky Morgan. I don't know if you've heard of it, but there's a thing called post-truth. And post-truth is where you feed people what they want to hear on emotions. Now, anybody listening to Nicky Morgan and the Treasury Select Committee talking to the two Keystone Cops from the City of London Police, for which he was dressed worse than a scruffy French waiter. The thing is, the talk between Nicky Morgan, the chair of the Treasury Select, was all about how rosy it is and how the police are helping the banks. A load of crap. They are helping the banks, but to cover up the fraud. So City of London Police will then pass any bank criminality normally to Avon Somerset with Lloyds. Avon Somerset now are even if it hasn't gone to Bristol or Avon Somerset, I know a victim. The crime on him happened in Kent. He wasn't an SME. He's a normal chap with a normal job who worked on the ferries. And with him, I said, you ought to get your diesel. And we got it. There's applications in there with wrong birth dates on it. There's bits in there where they've just cancelled endowments, so there's no exit vehicle on his mortgage. So the scary thing is, Lloyds Bank are not just criminally and civilly fraud going after SMEs. They're also doing it to Joe Public. And with that chap, he went to Kent Police. I went with him to Kent Police HQ. And they said, we're not allowed to touch it. We've been told we've got to pass it to Avon Somerset. So any fraud goes to Avon Somerset. And they rubber stamp it that there's no fraud, which is a load of crap. And a lot of people lose their properties. And more asset theft.
What was your experience at the police and crime panel? Because you came right the way over, didn't you, to Western Supermare from Kent?
Yeah, I come over. I mean, Mum is extremely ill at the moment, and, you know, as you know, but the thing is, this has got to stop. We've got to stop these bank coppers. It's like Sue Mount Stevens. She says there's no criminality there. Well, she's either in on it or she's thick. And I'm sorry, I had to drive up there. Me and Tracy come up there to basically say, you know, you as a police crime commissioner, you've got a duty. You've got the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act. And that says that the police crime commissioner has got to be a police and crime commissioner. Like a good one, like Anthony Stansfield, they've got to hold the police chief to account. And when his staff don't do what they should be, they hold them to account. You've got another policing protocol, which is a statute in 2011. You've got the oath of the police crime commissioner. I will voice the concerns of the people and make sure the police are efficient and righteous and all that. Well, they don't, you know. But if you've got bent police crime commissioners, you know, it's like having the full pack, isn't it? You know, you've got the Jaces, you've got the Jacks, you've got the Aces, you've got the Kings, Queens, and you've got the Jokers. And that's what Lloyds Bank and Avon Somerset Police are. You've got Lloyds, you've got RBS. As Lloyds and RBS close up more shops, some other banks are opening. And some people are now saying, you know, is there question marks with Metro Bank? I know people have had problems with Santander. And Barclays. Barclays, another one. But it all seems to be the same patterns. A lot of these bank managers, they move about and they take the bad habits with them. And, you know, does somebody leave one bank after many years in senior position, and do they set up sort codes that they can money launder through? And do they leave them sitting there dormant, attached maybe to Overshore's off-sea accounts? And then do they move to another bank so that when they pay money into wherever it's going, you know, dodgy thing. But like I say,
what about the FSA? Aren't they supposed to regulate banks?
The who?
FSA, isn't it? Financial Services Authority?
I've not heard them doing a lot in regulation lately. I guess you mean Financial Conduct Authority. Well, I don't know. They oversee a lot of conduct lately. I know there's an awful lot of victims that are losing their homes and going through hell. And they're saying, who is this FCA? The other thing is FOSS. And what I've worked out with FOSS is if you've got a small claim or dispute, £1,000, £30,000, £40,000, they might agree with you. But then again, if you've got a £30 or £40 million claim or a £10 million claim, FOSS will say, oh, no, we can't see any fraud. Even in my case, when a senior manager at BSU has told a lower manager at BSU to lie to FOSS, and I've got the evidence of it, and FOSS still don't find in your favour. But then again, I suppose a lot of £10, £20 million claims keeps a lot of £5,000, £10,000 claims happy.
So what did you actually say at the police and crime panel? And can you just, you know, did you get any?
It's not fit for purpose. That's the sum of it. I pointed out a couple of names of bank coppers they've got. Sue Mount Stevens has always gave the statement, oh, can't see any criminality, we'd look at new bits. And I said, no, it's not good enough. You're not doing your job. You're not fit for purpose. You know, she should be sacked. And if not, the police crime panel should invite in Anthony Stansfield. We all trust him. And they should let his police force have a free run. They're a lot bigger. And see what's not been investigated. A lot of us victims have got evidence. So look at that and find out why Avon Somerset can't see the fraud. They're either very thick or they're in on it. I know what fraud, property fraud is. I used to advise the government on it. It's very funny how a lot of fraud officers in Avon Somerset don't know what fraud is. But even now, they're quietening like Kent Police and a lot of other forces. It's wrong. I know one of the victims, which I also raised, and I didn't mention the person, but it's very interesting that a senior bank manager from BSU is on my DSAR, and additionally interviewed another Lloyds BSU victim, and they found out he was a senior manager from Lloyds posing as a police officer inside the Avon and Somerset Police HQ. How does he get let in? I think the trouble is, if you look at the FCA, somebody said to me that they've got a very big overdraft with Lloyds Bank. And if you look at the City of London Police, if you were to Google City of London Police Lloyds Bank partnership, you will see that Lloyds Bank sponsors City of London Police for the next 3 years, £500,000 per year to help with fraud. But I wonder in what way to help with fraud. It's definitely not to help uncover it.
Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Panel are now investigating Trevor Mealham's claim that the Police Commissioner Sue Mount Stevens has failed to hold our police at Avon and Somerset to account for not acting on evidence of alleged fraud by the Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit based here in Castle Park. I stress we do not support Trevor Mealham's claim, but believe that these claims must be aired and in the public domain in the public interest. That's all for this week. Dial X, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in your car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. First of all, Brett Christophers, author of The New Enclosures, The Appropriation of Public Land in Neoliberal Britain. And then just now from Trevor Mealham. He's the founder of the Independent Network of Estate Agents here in the UK and former advisor to the British government on property fraud. Thanks also to studio engineers Dave Pazanko and Joss Chivers. Dial X, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. or on the phone at 0117 909 6897. If you have some precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, Ofcom Willing, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.